Slow Burn Media and Bill Huffman present the 100th episode of Who Killed with special guest Nick from the True Crime Garage podcast.
Growing impatient, the Cleveland Press runs an editorial urging police to take action against the prime suspect. 4 days later, a front page editorial increases pressure on the police. The following day, the press devotes most of its front page to the case. An editorial addressed directly to the county coroner, Dr. Gerber, urges an immediate inquest. The next day, an inquest begins.
I jumped off the couch and ran upstairs. I thought I saw a white form standing in our bedroom. Then I think I was struck from behind and knocked out. When I came to, I went over to where Marilyn was. I felt she was gone. I believe I then rushed into our son Chip's room. After seeing him, I came to the conclusion he was unharmed. As I came out of Chip's room, I thought I heard a noise downstairs. I spotted a figure near the outside door, and I chased it down the path toward the beach.
Growing impatient, the Cleveland Press runs an editorial urging police to take action against the prime suspect. 4 days later, a front page editorial increases pressure on the police. The following day, the press devotes most of its front page to the case. An editorial addressed directly to the county coroner, Dr. Gerber, urges an immediate inquest. The next day, an inquest begins. Newspapers headline Coroner Gerber's theory that the murder weapon was a surgical instrument. This theory, never proved but widely publicized, is damaging to Dr. Shepherd.
Meanwhile, all of Cleveland awaits an answer to the question that has gone unanswered for 3 months. Who, in the early morning hours of July 4th, murdered Marilyn Shepherd? Was it her husband, Sam Shepherd, as the state charges? Or was it a mysterious, bushy-haired intruder, as claimed by Dr. Shepherd?
We, the jury in this case, being duly impaneled and sworn, do find the defendant, Sam H. Shepherd, not guilty of murder in the first degree, but guilty of murder in the second degree. James C. Byrd, foreman.
Hello and welcome to the 100th episode of Who Killed? I am your host, Bill Huffman. And of course, this is a Slow Burn Media podcast. Thank you so much to all of you guys for listening and supporting us to get to this point. It's an honor to bring you guys a new show each and every week. On last week's episode, I gave you the timeline and the nuts and bolts of the murder of Marilyn Shepherd, along with a media sensation surrounding the trial of her husband, Sam. On this week's episode, I have the one and only Nick from the True Crime Garage podcast to break down the Shepherd case. We will discuss the suspects, the trial, the wrestling career, as well as some of the more sensational aspects of the murder of Marilyn Shepherd. We will discuss whether we think Richard Eberlein is a good suspect, as well as whether or not we think Sam was involved. And to recap, the murder of Marilyn Shepherd happened on the night of July 3rd, 1954, after a night of hosting friends for dinner and cocktails. Sam said he got into a confrontation with a bushy-haired man shortly after midnight, and that he was knocked out not once, but twice, as he chased the man down the shores of Lake Erie. Sam became a media magnet. He was good-looking, affluent, and a doctor. Marilyn was beautiful, and she was a homemaker, as well as taught Bible lessons at the local Methodist church. Once the press got a hold of the case, they were off and running. Daily headlines called for Sam's arrest. And again, that did not help the prosecution, at least in the end, and gave no chance of Sam being acquitted. So the case turned out to be, at the time, the longest trial in American history. The murder of Marilyn Shepherd and the eventual acquittal of Sam served as the inspiration for the 1960s television show The Fugitive, and then into an Academy Award-winning movie starring the one and only Harrison Ford. Nobody other than Sam was taken to trial for the murder of his wife and the mother of their son, Chip. This is one of the reasons the case still fascinates not only the community, but the country. who killed Marilyn Shepard. So let's get into my conversation with Nick from the True Crime Garage podcast and see if we can't talk this out. I am very lucky to have Nick from the True Crime Garage podcast on this very special 100th episode of Who Killed. He has been a mentor along the way, and I really do appreciate him joining me on many episodes, and I know that he has a little bit of knowledge about the case that we are discussing, and again, that's the case of Who Killed Marilyn Shepard. Nick, thanks again for joining me.
Good morning, Bill. You are lucky to have me. I'm not as lucky. I'm lucky to be on your show and be talking with you on this beautiful morning. However, this is a very difficult case to really kind of figure out who actually did this. And I listened to part one, and you did a fantastic job of laying out everything, all of the bits of knowledge that everybody needs to know going into this case. And for the younger listeners, one thing that they may not be able to fully grasp when looking at this case is this case was huge. This was big, big news. And I liken this case to the JonBenet Ramsey case. It really shares a lot of similarities when you start to think about it. We have a case where they're basically trying someone in the public eye and in the newspapers and through the media. And we have a similar situation where you're left at the end of the day going, okay, this is a brutal homicide. It's still unsolved 65 years later. And we're left going, okay, was it an intruder or was it someone inside the home that killed this woman? And of course, the family itself is polarizing just as the Ramseys were. I mean, we're talking about people that are fairly well-to-do. And back in 1950s, this is the handsome young doctor. He's married to the beautiful young woman. They got the perfect life from the outside. And when you peel back the curtain and you look inside, you figure out that things are not so perfect, as they rarely are in most homes throughout America. And Shepard is a he's a skirt chaser, and he's probably not that great of a husband and a family man. And we have this situation where from the very onset of it, it looks pretty cut and dried, where, okay, there must have been some kind of argument. There must have been some kind of blow up between these two. Things got violent. Shepard lost his cool, flew off the handle and beat Marilyn to death. And now he's got to cover this thing up. But it's just not that simple, is it? When you dive into this case, when you go through Shepard's story of what happened that night, when you overlap that with what the neighbors say, what their friends said that were visiting that night, and then we have the son, Chip, as well, who hears nothing, sees nothing, the only other person in the home. And he for the rest of his life, fights for his father's good name, to clear his father's name in the murder of his mother. It's truly a fascinating case. And I understand why it has not been solved all of these years later, although it's been tried many times.
Yeah, you know, and it is very interesting, the whole media aspect and how much of the media played a role in this case. And, you know, obviously there's parallels between this case, the trial, and the O.J. Simpson trial, especially with the similarities, considering F. Lee Bailey was a part of both cases. And, you know, that goes to say something about his longevity. But nonetheless, the reason for this case, I think, for not being solved also is, I talked about it in early part of the episode, in part one, about how basically everybody was able to just wander through the house and disturb the crime scene before it was even, you know, closed to the public. There were neighbors walking through, there were authorities.
Reporters. This was not a clean crime scene as far as that goes. And
it was brutal.
It was a brutal homicide. And throughout the the battle, you know, if we are to believe Dr. Shepard's story of what went down that night when he woke up and discovered his wife was being brutally attacked. And then he has to fight this man, and he's knocked out, knocked unconscious twice. If we are to believe his story, well, then that crime scene, that home, and on down to the beach area, that's all incredibly important to investigators. However, now you have everybody and their brother stepping all over your crime scene. And there should have been things, there should have been clues and evidence within that crime scene to really point us in one direction or the other, because the two possibilities are very different from one another. There's a big difference in a crime scene having there been a fourth person in that home. As you said, this is a brutal attack. There should be evidence of that individual inside that home. And then when you put all these other yahoos in there, well, that just convolutes the whole mess altogether.
Yeah, I mean, it basically throws fingerprint evidence out the window. And if you think about it, one of the most interesting aspects of the murder itself is Chip was like 6 feet from the bedroom where Marilyn was killed. And for as awful as a murder as it was, I don't know how he couldn't have heard the murder taking place. It's just that, I don't know.
It's something that's very difficult to wrap your head around, that Chip would not have woke up at some point during this attack, regardless of who the attacker was.
Right.
And yet it appears that he did not. And I don't have any reason to not believe him. And I find it in very much in Sam Shepard's favor, Dr. Shepard's favor, that Chip spent a good majority of his life trying to clear his father's name.
Yeah. I mean, I remember growing up, you know, in the 90s, basically, I think in 1989 is when Sam Jr. stepped forward and basically started fighting for his dad's, you know, name to be cleared. And so all through the 90s, I remember that being one of the headline stories on the local news. Basically, you know, anytime something came up, and I think it was in 96 that they started reinvestigating the case. And it's just, you know, the fact that, okay, so 1996, that's 42 years after the murder. And we already know that within 48 hours, it's already tough to solve a crime. To imagine, you know, it's hard to imagine, right? 42 years. And that's what, you know, we run into that with a lot of cold cases, I think. And I think that's why a lot of cold cases don't get solved, is because people just obviously don't remember, die, memories fade. It just is what it is. And the thing that stands out the most to me about this case is his story about, you know, fighting with this bushy-haired man and the fact that he was knocked out twice. And I think that, I just don't know. I mean, is that even possible?
Well, I'm
not a doctor. I know you went to school for computer. So, you know, I guess it's possible.
So my little understanding of concussions come from the NFL and everything they've taught us about the dangers of concussions and such. And one thing that I learned from reviewing their process and the information they've put out over the years is that once you've had one concussion, the second and third and fourth concussion they're that much easier to get. So and therein lies the problem. And that's why you see with like the NFL, where they'll make a player sit out for next week or a period of weeks, because they're worried that you just bump this guy on the head, he might get another one real quick. So that is my limited understanding of that situation. But one thing that's bizarre in this case, and this case is unique for so many different reasons, and I think let's go through some of that right now. First, the first thing that you see after you get past the crime scene, the contaminated crime scene with everybody stepping all over the place and putting their fingers all over the place. You know, we should also point out this is the 50s. And back then, fingerprint evidence was considered the way we could talk about DNA evidence today. It was that damning back then. And so that's the first hurdle. And then the second hurdle is such a unique situation where, you know, we still hold doctors in high regard and in high esteem, but even more so back then. And you were almost locally famous, you know, famous at the local level if you were the doctor or the surgeon in town.
Sure.
And everybody knew you were the doctor.
Yeah, my grandfather was a urologist on the west side of Cleveland in the 1950s. So,
and everywhere he went, people probably called him doctor. That's who they knew him to be.
Dr. Huffman.
And so back then, especially, you have officers who are interviewing a guy that they consider to be a suspect, but also somebody that they hold in high regard, that they have a certain level of respect for. And so there's that imbalance of inferiority going on. But then let's go ahead and compound that with the fact that you're going to interview this man because he may be a victim himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he has sustained several injuries, regardless if he got them from fighting off Maryland's attacker or if he got them from killing his wife.
Yeah, because he was injured.
Yes, he was physically and visibly injured. It was there's no doubting that. So they take him to be treated for his injuries, and we're going to interview him while he's being treated or shortly after being treated for these injuries. Well, where is that questioning, the initial questioning, going to take place? At a hospital where this guy's going to feel comfortable because he's a doctor. But it's the hospital he works at. Oh, it's the hospital that his family owns. He's got brothers and a father that work there as well. So,
yep.
This is not an interrogation or questioning this man under the hot lights in some dark, smoky police room at the station down at the, you know, take him down to the station and grill this guy. No, this dude is lying in a hospital bed. He's giving his side of the story.
And he's sedated.
He's sedated. We should all be sedated. But
needless to say,
given the current state of affairs. But not only that, this dude he's the king of the ring at this hospital, right? He's in there being treated like a king, nurses coming in and out while he's giving his account of what's going on and, you know, tending to his every need. And then he goes off into this very doctor scientific type speak when he's giving his account of what went down that night. It's almost like he's writing an entry in some kind of an article for like a medical journal or something. And so when the public views Shepard's point of view and account of what went down, they're not going to be able to identify with this. And that also becomes an issue here for Shepard and for the case itself. If he is a victim, if his wife was murdered inside their home by an intruder, then this man is a victim. However, he is not likable to the public.
Mm-mm.
There's nobody outside of his son and his immediate family that are saying, Sam didn't do this. Shepard didn't do this. No, the general public are going, this guy was cheating on his wife. He put on the front of a do-gooder, of a healer, of somebody who takes care of the community. And in reality, he's a bad guy. He's a bad husband. If you cheat on your wife, you cheat on anything. And it makes him not likable. It makes him not identifiable with the general public. And then, you know what sells newspapers better than anything? I mean, okay, box scores sell newspapers, elections sell newspapers, but even better than that, especially for longevity, Jack the Ripper, Zodiac, the Unabomber, those guys sold a hell of a lot of newspapers
and still sell a lot of books about them. I mean, the paper, that there's still books written about Jack the Ripper every year. I mean, that case is 120 years old.
And this case became big, big news. And guess what that meant? A lot of newspapers being sold in the Cleveland area.
We had two newspapers at the time. We had the Cleveland Press and the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and evening editions as well.
And now their headlines are being broadcast throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, these are two of the biggest papers in the country as far as what people want to know, what people want to hone in on. And they really latched on to this idea of Shepard being the number one suspect. And they kept telling and pushing and pushing. Why aren't they questioning this guy? Why haven't they arrested this guy? Why hasn't there not been an inquest? To the point where it's they're almost like they're pacing it out over a period of weeks to keep stringing along the readers, mm-hmm. right? And they don't have Shepard's best interest at heart. They don't give a shit about the investigation at the end of the day either. Their job is to sell newspapers, and they did a brilliant job of pacing this thing out over several weeks to string along these readers and these buyers to where it led up to the climax of the "Do it now, Dr. Gerber." You know, they're screaming it from the mountaintops. Let's have an inquest. And when you didn't have to read between the lines to understand, they weren't screaming for an inquest. That's the PC thing to do. Mm-hmm. Let's call. We demand an inquest. No, you didn't have to read between the lines to understand. They were calling for his arrest, to arrest Dr. Shepard, try him, lock him up, throw away the key, and let's forget about this guy and let him rot away in some cold cell for the rest of his life.
Yeah. And again, the press, this is really when, you know, obviously I think you had the Lindenberg baby trial that was the biggest trial before this trial. And this is the first time I think the press really gets held to task for basically being overzealous and basically screwing up the investigation as far as focusing in on one individual. And like you said, you know, every day they would ramp it up. And I talked about it last week about how it was like every other day would be a headline about why isn't he arrested or why isn't he questioned? And then the statement that you just asked or said about why isn't there an inquest? And guess what? There was an inquest the next day. And it's like, and you mentioned the Cleveland Press and the Plain Dealer being broadcast all across the country at that point. And yeah, nationally, now the New York Times is running stuff, the Daily News, the Post, the Chicago Tribune. I mean, it's everywhere. And it's a media circus. I mean, they called it a media carnival.
Right.
So, I mean, it's really a shame. It's a stain on the press to a degree, because they really were the ones that made that singular focus. And then we always talk about how the police focus, you know, on one suspect, and that blinds them to other potential suspects. And you cannot disagree that the papers were doing the same exact thing, right? I mean, isn't that what they were basically doing? They were trying to steer this investigation to just convict him.
Well, it's shoddy and dishonest journalism at the end of the day, but
it's sold newspapers.
It's wonderful for the reader, right? True. That's your customer. True. It's like a daily soap opera that you're going to tune into. Oh man, I can't wait for tomorrow's paper to pick it up and figure out did Dr. Sam do this? You know, people want to know for themselves whether it's going to be tried or not. They want to be able to read the facts. They want to be able to tear through the case and sip their morning coffee and get up. And when they go off to their job that day, they want to go, you know what? All right, I got something to talk to old Jim about at the water cooler. I'm pretty certain the Shepard guy's guilty, and that's because the local media has told me so. But it's a fascinating case from that angle, and to see how it played out in the papers, even though they were really force feeding it to us by that point. And then you have a judge. The first judge takes a look at this thing and says, there's not really much here. Mm-mm. You know, and I've heard the statements and read that there was quote unquote nothing, you know, no evidence against Shepard. And I don't know that is the full story. Who knows? It's really hard to say. I'm guessing that a judge is looking at this thing and going, there might be something here, but we got one shot at this. And if you know, he's there to represent the community and uphold the law and the laws that we have put into place. And a judge does not want a mistrial. That, I mean, that goes against everything they're supposed to do, and does not want something brought before their court that has no business being there yet. That's not ready one way or another.
Right. And I mean, you notice that they release him, you know, on bail, because like you said, they didn't have anything. So quote unquote, but again, he gets indicted the next day for murder and is arrested and then isn't released until his acquittal 10 years later. You know, it's really interesting to think about how the first trial, okay, you know, one of the things that stood out was all the media, obviously, the first three or four rows of the courtroom were all dedicated to media. They had this huge table with all of Sam's lawyers. I mean, he had the means and the money and the power to fight this case. But again, with the public's access to the press and all the articles that they were writing, I mean, the jury wasn't sequestered.
No.
I mean, if you think about a failure as a judge in the biggest trial of the century at this point, you don't sequester the jury. And not only that, you have the jury get interviewed by reporters, as well as just they're never even questioned about what they know about the case or heard about the case after certain broadcasts have been made. I think that's a complete failure on the judge's part. And it's like they were purposely doing that. It's like they were turning a blind eye. Though they won't listen to that stuff.
Well, and then that, when at the end of the day, that's when as a community, you stand up and you say, you know what, we don't care for this. And we're not going to reelect, you know, these people that have flawed our system.
But the system won reelection.
Right. Well, right. Again, but the people had the power to make sure that didn't happen. and the thing is, that's the power of the press, especially back in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
If you had the press on your side as someone who's seeking election, you almost had the thing in the bag, right? And so why not dedicate the first three rows to the media? Why not give them carte blanche to do what they will with your trial? And
they turned the courtroom, I mean, the whole courthouse, into basically a media empire. I mean, they were broadcasting radio, television, you know, obviously newspapers stories were being written there, and, you know, telegraphed or whatever, you know, back in the day. And that was the whole courthouse, just inundated with reporters. And again, it cannot be harped on enough that the jury wasn't sequestered. I mean, anybody in their right mind, if they were on the jury, why wouldn't they pick up the newspaper and read it? I mean, they're looking at something else in the newspaper regardless. How could they avoid the front page?
This week's episode is brought to you by Best Fiends. Working as a true crime podcaster, I research some dark subjects. And when I need to brighten my day, I turn to Best Fiends. Best Fiends is a puzzle game you can play right on your phone. And it's truly a great game. You will have a mindful experience as you traverse through all the different levels while facing challenging puzzles. But Best Fiends is a fun, casual game that anyone can play. I'm definitely not an expert, but I've been moving through these levels pretty quickly. And one of the best parts is Best Fiends updates monthly, so there's new levels and events, so it will always stay fresh. Best Fiends won't take up much of your time, but what it will do is it will help you stay in touch with the friends and family, all while still social distancing. And another great feature, you don't even need an internet connection to play. The game has a gorgeous design, and I find that it helps relax my mind. Plus, the cute characters just make it all the better. So engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, This 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. I've had to deal with my fair share of anxiety and depression in my life, and I'm happy to say that there is now an easy way to get help. Because if there is something that interferes with your happiness or is holding you back from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. You can now connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's convenient because it needs to be in our hectic lives. So go get help on your own time and at your own pace. You can schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. BetterHelp really is there for you. They have 3,000 U.S. licensed therapists across all 50 states. And guess what? If you aren't happy with your counselor for any reason, you can request a new one at any time. There are even apps available for your computer or smartphone. So whether you're suffering from anxiety, depression, anger, stress, relationship issues, sleeping, trauma, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, or self-esteem, they literally have a licensed professional counselor for you. And of course, everything you share is confidential. The best part is, it's a truly affordable option. Who Killed listeners get 10% off their first month with the discount code WHO. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/WHO. All you have to do is fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. Again, for 10% off, go to betterhelp.com/WHO.
Yeah. Yeah. We actually did a talk on this case a few years ago back at the Ohio Crime and Corruption event at the Ohio Historic Society, I believe is the, it's changed its name over the years, so I get confused on, I think it's the History Society, but
that's one of the reasons, you told me that before, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on to discuss this case, because I knew that you had done that talk.
It was a fascinating day at the History Society. They provided a lot of photographs and newspaper clippings from the time period that people were able to view and look at before we gave our little talk, our True Crime Garage talk, there in one of the auditoriums. And they even had a nutshell diagram or constructed of the house, the layout of the house itself. Sure. with furniture and everything. And it was really fascinating to be able to hold that up and show the people in the audience and point and say, you know, this is where Marilyn was. This is where the son was sleeping. This is where Sam says that he fell asleep on the day bed. And you can see that their guests left through the front door. There's some question if the door was locked or not. There's different.
It was a different time and place. Right, and it's a safe area too.
Well, even more so though, there were different statements about the door being locked. Some who had said the door was locked and then others who said that the door was not locked. Regardless, the interesting thing though too is you were able to really take a look at the blood spatter evidence, and that is where a lot of this case, I mean, there are truths in there that cannot be denied when you look at that room. And the simplest way to explain this to someone that may not fully understand is this poor woman was basically brutally beaten as she's on the bed, and when whoever her attacker was, an intruder or Dr. Shepherd, as they're striking her, when they pull back up the weapon to strike again, is when you're going to get cast off, and that's going to create blood spatter. And you can actually view that room and determine where the attacker was when they were striking her at certain points during the attack, based off of where blood spatter did not end up behind the individual at all. It almost, you can almost envision an outline or a shadow or silhouette of the killer themselves off of the wall based around where the blood spatter goes. And so there are some truths in there. Now, keep in mind, this is 1954, so science had not caught up to this case yet. And I really feel like had this, whatever went down that night on the shores of Lake Erie, that had that happened in 2010, 2015, or last night, we would have a whole entirely different outcome. And I think much, much quicker too. We would have been led to a much, to a conclusion much quicker than, well, we never did get a conclusion, I guess, in this case. So,
yeah. And you look back at that case and you think about 1954 and what the investigators had to work with. And, you know, really it was fingerprint evidence and maybe blood typing, but it was, very, very, very early on in the days of detectives and investigating murders, and they didn't know what to look for. Whereas in 2010 and now, we've had plenty of examples of people who have lied. And if, you know, if there would have been an experienced interrogator from today interviewing Sam in 1954, if he was the killer, he would have been arrested probably that same day, in my opinion.
Correct. It's difficult to say, but yeah, I agree. I think the outcome would be completely different.
Well, it goes to show you too, when his second trial comes around and, you know, he's acquitted. Well, or let's see, he's acquitted and not acquitted. He's released, and then they appeals court votes 2-1 to reinstate his conviction, but they allow him to stay off, you know, out of jail on bail. And his trial lasts only a month compared to the, you know, 6-month or 4-month ordeal that he had gone through before. And then he's found not guilty. And
well, that's because whether he's guilty or not, that's because you have Effley Bailey there. I mean, when
Corrigan died, Bailey took over.
Yeah. And so you don't have to like the guy. I don't care if you think that he's putting killers out on the streets or not. At the end of the day, his job is to defend people who are being tried for heinous crimes. And whether you think OJ did it or not, I have a shirt. True Crime Garage has a shirt that says OJ did it. So you know where I stand on that. But Effley Bailey is a brilliant, brilliant man. I mean, he is the Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson of his profession.
True.
And it would have taken Michael Jordan or the Magic Johnson of their profession to get OJ Simpson off. And he was part of that dream team that helped with that. And then in this case, we have a young Effley Bailey who's really making a name for himself. And he did a lot of things at that trial that had not been done before, you know, the discussing of blood evidence and such. And it was
trial by press.
And it was also there was also some worry about that, right? Like, oh, you don't want to make this trial too complicated for the jurors so that they can't even understand what you're saying. But at the end of the day, it's conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. And so who cares if you make it too confusing for the juries to understand? You're probably at a better off point from a defense standpoint if they are confused, because if they are confused, it's difficult for them to say beyond a reasonable doubt this man killed his wife,
right?
And that then you go back to the first trial. Okay, they have in the papers that this woman has a baby out of wedlock, has an affair with Dr. Sam Shepard, and now they're having a baby. And then we find out, well, that's
not even true. No, not even true. No truth to that.
She just wanted to be part of the story.
Shocking. I mean,
you know what? I really wonder at the end of the day, you know, this trial by 12, the jurors, I wonder if you lined them up, did just one person out of that 12 go guilty because of that that affair, that fake affair that did not happen.
Well, he had other affairs, so there was plenty of reason to dislike him as a person. So yeah, people have personal.
Nobody's doubting that, but this is the one that was in the paper.
Yeah, they broadcast it and stuff, and it was like, is there any legitimacy to this? Not one bit. And there was also like, I mean, they would talk about how it was Marilyn was killed with a surgical tool.
And which is not true,
which is 100% false,
right?
And was never brought up in trial again, right. Broadcast and published in the newspapers.
There's every indication from what I've reviewed over the years in this case that she would have been killed with maybe more than one object, but it was very likely something in the room with her, maybe a lamp or something that was heavy in the room with her, or a flashlight that one could easily come to the conclusion that the intruder brought with them to.
But yet they never found a murder weapon.
Correct.
Very interesting. And then, you know, F. Lee Bailey does his magic. And I do want people to know that I'm going to put I've got a 15-minute interview with him from I think 1964, I think it was before the retrial, whatever. But it's very interesting. It's like 15 minutes, and I'm going to play it at the end of this episode. So definitely take a listen to it. But once he was acquitted, the fact that, you know, again, he was a huge national story. He's on Johnny Carson a week after. A week after his acquittal, he was a international celebrity at this point. And I had mentioned in the first episode, I think, about how, you know, there was some connection between him and The Fugitive, the show and the movie. And, you know, I've had people on Twitter say that, no, that was just a coincidence. And it's like, well, if it was the biggest story in the world, even if the writer said it was not true or it was a coincidence, it was still subconsciously influenced by this trial. I mean, give me a break. And you think about what he went through after he was acquitted. I mean, he became a pro wrestler.
Well, yeah. And so, yeah, it's.
And married one of, let's see, he married Ariane Tabajones, who
she's 1 degree away from being a Nazi.
She went to Hitler's Nazi youth camps, and then she tried to sell a book about their life together. And apparently, shocking, the New York publishers weren't interested because she went on to say that the Hitler youth camps were similar to the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts.
Well, and you know, in your defense there, Bill, one of my favorite authors, Thomas Harris, has said, and he's a fictional author, and he says that everything that he writes is true. Meaning, yes, they're stories that he has created, but there are truths in them. They stem from true real life stories that were either in the paper or crimes that actually happened. And so in retaliation to that, I can't speak much to the TV show, The Fugitive. I've probably only seen bits and pieces of it. And
yeah, I mean, I haven't watched it. It was 1960s.
Right. And but the movie itself, the 1993 movie, The Fugitive.
Great movie.
There's no way that it doesn't have some. It's not based off of a bushy-haired man. The guy's a doctor. An intruder kills his wife for an unbeknownst reason. It's there's a conspiracy involved at the end of the day. But one of my favorite scenes in that movie, and one of my favorite scenes out of any crime thriller movie, is the part where Tommy Lee Jones almost catches up.
I know exactly this part.
To Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
And Harrison Ford turns and looks at him, and he says, "I didn't kill my wife." And Tommy Lee Jones goes, "I don't care." And because, you know, Tommy Lee Jones' job is just to bring the man in. The guy's a fugitive, and he's not there to try him to put the doctor on trial and to figure out if the guy did it or not. No, he's just tasked with apprehending him. And it's brilliant piece of film, because it's the two characters at their purest, when you scrape everything away, this is a man who has been wrongfully convicted face to face with a man who's trying to apprehend him. And the man that apprehends him, all he cares about at the end of the day is bringing this guy in, whether he did it or not. So that was a brilliant movie. But back to the case, did you, when you were reviewing this, did you find, and we talked about murder weapon there for a minute, did you find any obvious statements or any obvious conclusion that anything was missing from the home other than what was believed to have been quote unquote stolen or made to look like it was stolen?
Something about fire pokers or a fire poker that was discovered at the Hauks house. But that was in 1982. And I don't know if that came from the Shepherd house. I would have to double check on that.
So the Hauks, if that in so fact were the murder weapon, the Hauks ended up with the murder weapon and yeah, they were just fine with that for years.
So yeah, it's interesting.
I want to take a moment to tell you about my podcast, Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage. In 1984, a woman named Phyllis Cottle was abducted in broad daylight, tortured, and left to die in a burning car in Akron, Ohio. At the time, I was a rookie reporter covering this horrific story. Since then, I've reported every kind of crime imaginable. I've been able to leave most of them at work, but not this one. The one that buried itself under my skin and stayed put. Phyllis Cottle was a badass woman, and I want to tell you her story. A production of Evergreen Podcasts and signature title of the Killer Podcast Network, you can find Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage wherever you get your podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcast.com.
So, like, Cleveland State has all of Sam Shepard's stuff. Like, they donated all of the, all the trial transcripts and all that other stuff to the school. And I'm going to say that, let's see. Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things. I never really saw exactly where they were, where they found that, where they found the fire poker. But I know it was, I know it was at the Hauks. I just don't know if it belonged to the, to Sam. And I know that he was looked at as a possible suspect. I mean, that we know. Because that was one of the possibilities that they brought up, as he was possibly having an affair with Marilyn. And that's why Sam, or I don't know. No, it was Sam was having an affair with Spencer's wife.
Right, with his wife.
Yeah, that was the rumor. But again, rumor, innuendo, that's really all this case was really built about.
So great. Another case where we have an unsolved murder and they find a fire poker years after the fact.
That sounds awfully familiar.
Yeah. This is a difficult case to come to a conclusion, obviously.
We have owls.
Right. But I will say this, as far as the intruder theory goes in this case, it is an ideal home for someone to break into for several reasons. One, we talked about how it backs up to Lake Erie. The layout of the property itself, if you were to enter that home in the middle of the night from the rear of the home, it's very unlikely that you're going to have anyone, neighbors or otherwise, see you come and go from that house. So from that standpoint, from a criminal mind standpoint, the house, if you're looking to burglarize, this is an ideal house. This is an ideal neighborhood for that, because you're going to find items of value because of the neighborhood, because of these are upper class people. Mm-hmm. And it's easy. You're cloaked under the cover of night and the layout of the property itself. And just the fact that there's no one living behind them. And yeah, then if I mean, you take it a step further, say they never found a murder weapon. Well, what does a guy that intends to burglarize a home in the middle of the night bring with them for their adventure, their excursion? Right. A flashlight.
Uh-huh.
And if he has to use it to beat somebody to death with once he's inside the home, he's going to take it with him when he leaves. And there is probably the simplest answer as to why you didn't find a murder weapon. Now, you can also take that a step further and say, well, Sam Shepard was no idiot. He was no moron, I like to say. And he probably, you know, he could have beat his wife and then thrown the murder weapon in Lake Erie for all we know. But there were items that were removed from the house. Who removed them? We can't say 100% certain, but they were removed from the home. They were found outside of the home. It's believed that maybe these items were dropped by the burglar after the scuffle with Shepard outside, possible. Also thought that maybe they hid them to try to come back and retrieve them at another time is always a possibility. Then we have the weird situation of a piece of her jewelry. I believe it was her ring that this character, it's found in his possession.
Yeah.
That, Marilyn Shepard's ring is found in, who was it? Eberling's
Richard possession. Eberling.
And there is some thought that he may have stole that from, like, so that sounds like a very damning piece of evidence, right? But I think if I remember this correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Bill, like mm-hmm. I said, it's been a couple of years, but if I remember correctly, that the story behind that ring, that stolen ring, it's actually believed that he stole it from her sister, from Marilyn Shepard's sister.
It was
at a later date. It wasn't stolen that night when Marilyn was attacked.
Right. Exactly. It sounds like, you know, it sounded like, oh, you know, he took it from there, but I think it was actually he took it from her, from Sam's brother.
Sam's brother. Okay.
Yeah. And you know, you were talking about how he could have thrown the, and we were just talking about the murder weapon. Yeah. So according to famoustrials.com, the 3 months after, and this is July 1955, so Sam's already been convicted. And so it's a year after the murder. A swimmer who lived next to the Shepherd home, quote, found a dented flashlight, not a surgical instrument, in the shallow water in Lake Erie. Yeah. Yeah.
And look, there's a million ways that that flashlight could have ended up in Lake Erie.
Of course.
It could have come from any number of people.
Could have come from Sam.
Could have come from Sam.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and you think about, again, I always talk about this particular case, you know, about trial by media. And, you know, it's interesting that the publisher of the Cleveland Press actually wrote in his autobiography, talked about how, you know, how strong of a role he played in bringing Shepard to justice. And it's, you know, it's crazy. And you think about all the tragedy that surrounded the family. You know, I think Sam's dad killed himself. Marilyn's dad killed himself. Or no, Sam's mother killed himself, but Marilyn's dad killed himself. And then Sam's dad died like a year after he was convicted.
Of them were dealing with ailments, though, right? Weren't some of them dealing with some pretty severe health issues?
Yeah, well, Marilyn's father was, significantly. Okay. But the other, I keep screwing that up. It's Sam's father that had the real issues. And then Sam's mom killed herself in a motel somewhere in Cleveland. So, interesting. Hmm. And, yeah, they actually grew up, you know, not grew up, but where Sam lived after his trial is about 2 miles from where I live. And it's the townhouses that he's interviewed in front of in one of the AP videos. It's like this, they look exactly the same, the townhomes. It's just, it's so bizarre how close this is to, again, another Bay Village story. Another unsolved murder and another international or national mystery.
Well, and I think that Shepard eventually moved down to my neck of the woods, to Columbus, in a small area that we call German Village. And that was so he could somewhat practice medicine again.
I think that is correct. Yeah. And then,
because good luck having any clientele up in Northeast Ohio. After.
Yeah, because Columbus is so far away that you would not know about Sam Shepard. No,
that's true.
So final thoughts, Nick. I know that you are on a time restraint today. So any final thoughts that you have on the Shepard case and whether or not you think you can make a definitive conclusion?
I don't know that I can make a conclusion, judge, jury, executioner style here, but I would find it very difficult to put a guilty verdict if I were a jury member in either of those trials. I don't see enough here to convict this man. And in fact, if I had to choose, gun to my head, I would think I go with the intruder theory, that I think that it's more likely that there was an intruder. And I understand that the percentages and the statistics tell us that Sam Shepard probably, you know, more likely than not was the killer. But I go back to the son, and, you know, he didn't wake up. Some have to wonder, well, maybe he did wake up, and maybe when he saw who was killing his mother, it was his father. And but then if you're going to go that angle, really think about that for a second, because right. I've heard people try to apply that to this case. What it would be his motive all those years later to stand by his father and not hate his father? If in fact he did see his father kill his mother, it makes no sense at the end of the day. And that's not what happened. That didn't happen. And so I see a situation where we have three people in the home, and unfortunately this woman is brutally attacked. There is some question too about sexual assault in this case. And when we want to talk about statistics and apply those to, you know, solved case statistics to this unsolved case, if we want to apply that and say, hey, what is the likelihood? What are the percentages here comparing Sam Shepard as prime suspect to the intruder theory? If in fact there was a sexual assault, then the statistics go way down. The percentages go way down for the husband being the actual attacker. So again, it comes back to science and forensics and investigative tools and resources were not up to speed. They are not where they are today. And back in 1954, in the 50s, there are a lot of questions that would have become answers based off of what we're able to do today.
Yeah, and I would say that when I first started looking into this case a while back, I went in with I went in with the belief that it was Sam. And the more that I look at it, the more I listen to his interview, the fact that he took, okay, so if the story's real, that he chased him down, this intruder down the stairs to the beach, that would follow up and basically, what's the word I'm looking for? Help your side of the story about the person coming in from the back and knowing the back way. And that's exactly what I think could have happened, is if that's the way you came in. Well, why isn't that the way you're going to go out?
Especially in haste. And when you're trying to now flee from someone who's trying to either apprehend you or attack you or what have you, you're going to go the route that you know. And we see that again, applying statistics, very often the intruder will flee from the same point of entry into the home. And look, at the end of the day, Richard Eberling is as good of a suspect as Dr. Sam Shepard. Eberling is
if
a
not
freaking
better.
He's a freaking creep.
He's a convicted killer.
He's a murderer. He's a creep. And he, you know, he fits some of the weird descriptions that people say they may have saw someone in the neighborhood that night. You know, and it's interesting that you say, hey, you went into this thinking that Dr. Sam Shepard did kill Marilyn Shepard that night. And then you've kind of rethought that. And when you come out the other end of this, you're thinking much differently. When we gave our talk to that auditorium at the crime and corruption event, the Ohio crime and corruption event, there must have been, I would estimate, about 50, 60 people in the audience. And we probably discussed the case for a good 45 minutes to an hour. And we did much like what you did last week, where we just started at the beginning, chronologically went through the whole thing. We were able to go in depth with Richard Eberling and some of the other things that Effley Bailey presented at trial as this case progressed. And at the end of our talk, I asked for a little audience participation. I said, you know, I'm going to give you three options. And when I get to the option you like the best, I want you to raise your hand. And the options were Dr. Sam Shepard, Richard Eberling, or an unknown offender. And the one that got the most hands at the end of that talk was Richard Eberling. And so it's again, it would be very difficult based off of what we had, the knowledge that we had, the evidence that we had or did not have back then. It would be difficult for a conviction of Dr. Sam Shepard in my mind.
I agree. And if I was on that trial jury, I would have probably voted to acquit because, again, there was enough reasonable doubt and it just doesn't seem right. And again, trial by media is not a way to make a conviction stand. And again, let's remember, it only took a month to find him not guilty the second trial. So,
well, thanks again once again, Bill, for having me on. It's always a pleasure to drink a couple cups of coffee with you and talk always. Some true crime. If there's anybody listening to Who Killed that has not checked out True Crime Garage, check out our podcast, True Crime Garage. This week, we just released two shows about a strange disappearance of two young men, two separate incidents down in Florida. And the last known person to see them was a sheriff's deputy, the same sheriff's deputy. So very interesting case out of Florida that we covered this week. Next week, we got two different cases that we're going to cover on Tuesday and Wednesday. And then, Bill, you're going to like this. The following week, we are really taking a deep dive into some old Ohio cold cases. So check out True Crime Garage podcast. Wherever you hear this wonderful podcast, Who Killed, is the same place you can hear ours.
And you can still get your catalog on Stitcher, right?
Correct. And we're doing our very best to open it up to the world. But for now, all the old episodes are available 100% free to anyone on the Stitcher app.
All right. Nick, again, you're the man. Thanks so much for helping me get to episode 100. And I can't thank you enough for joining me.
Congratulations, Bill. I know I'll talk to you well before then, but have me back on for episode 200.
No, yeah, we'll talk. We'll talk a few times before that, probably. But yeah, you take care of yourself. Thanks again so much. And I always appreciate, and I know the audience always appreciates your knowledge. So
thanks, Bill.
Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks. Bye.
One more thing before I let you guys go on this case. And that is an interview with Effley Bailey that was conducted in the 1960s while defending Sam against the media sensation that was his trial. And again, it's interesting if you are a member of the press or have worked in a job related to media and see how much the media can actually impact the trial of a certain individual. And I mean, we've all seen cases such as OJ, Casey Anthony, Scott Peterson, you name it, there's been a billion media sensational trials. Jodi Arias comes to mind. And again, these are interesting because the press plays a big part in the public perception of who these individuals are. So take a listen. It's 15 minutes. And again, it's just interesting. And it's on the boot reporting from the 1960s. And
again, the audio is a little wonky just because of the fact that it's old, but it's really interesting, and enjoy, please.
Yes, but surely you wouldn't say indefinitely, even if it was a trivial offense, would you?
No, there are some offenses on which you can quickly put a limitation. Perhaps it's a fine.
Yeah.
I say indefinitely as to anyone who may be a danger to society. These are the people that you're really complaining about.
Yeah, yeah. So that ideally, then, each person would be treated as an individual. And as an individual, he would be assigned to the proper kind of reformatory, in effect, is what is involved, isn't it?
Yes, and the proper kind of celibus. Just breaking up rocks for 10 years doesn't really do much for a person. It probably does a great deal of damage.
Breaks a lot of rocks, too.
Yeah, it breaks a lot of rocks, but you can get a lot more efficient service out of a human being if you're going to put him in chains and to break rocks. And this is what most of them do, something not much more productive.
Well, that I think, is completely understandable, as far as I'm concerned, completely commendable. Even if the humanitarian dimension weren't involved, the utilitarian one is. Obviously,
certainly,
you're much better off getting somebody who commits a crime at age 20 and at age 30 is reformed and will lead a useful life rather
sure.
than using up your wardens. But there is danger, of course, of a sentimentality creeping in, which has the effect of always finding an excuse for every crime. And it seems to me that some professional defendants, I don't know you well enough to pass judgment on this, seem somehow always to be angling here. Is it your position that there are people who are just plain evil in the sense that they do not desire to curb their instincts, and that under the circumstances, whatever it was that caused them to become that way, society does need to, in its own defense, to isolate them?
Well, putting aside for a moment the psychiatric problems, because that very murky science doesn't help us much as it goes around slapping labels such as sociopathic and schizophrenic and so forth, doesn't enable us to predict or cure bad conduct. Nonetheless, the usual reason for the commission of a non-compulsive, non-obsessive crime, and I put all the sex people over in that area, is because the individual thinks that this is the most successful way to get what he wants. And indeed, many bank robbers make a great deal of money and never get caught, and they start businesses and become members of the PTA. There's got to be a way to teach them that you can wear a $150 suit without stealing it. And many of the clever criminals would be enormously successful in business, where many of their brethren operate within the law and every bit as viciously. And if they couldn't do that, they could become politicians.
That's right, yeah. That's right, because then theft is no problem at all.
Well, no, the requirement for any real moral standard disappears. One sort of shifts it to suit what the public is fancying that week, or at least this is my conception.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that may be a little bit cynical.
It is a little bit cynical, yeah. But...
I think you like to be a little bit cynical.
No, I like to put the bite in every now and then, because occasionally fellows put the bite into me, and it's a good exchange.
The trouble is, as an old anarchist, I rather resent your using my rhetoric about the similarities between bank robbers and politicians. I do very much deplore. However, it is, I think, true that there has been a discernible movement in social thought on the basis of which one never blames the criminal for anything at all. One blames his mother or his father or the society or the Republican Party or whatever, or the books he did read or, if not, the books he didn't read and so on. And whereas all of that may be, in a sense, true, if you assume as an etiological axiom that something causes everything, it's nevertheless true that, as far as the society is concerned, the objective is to keep him from doing it again. And I think that there's been a disproportionate amount of time given to that, as distinguished from how shall we revise society so as to make it perfectly pleasing to Al Capone.
No, you can't revise society to make it perfectly pleasing to Al Capone, although it might have been possible at one stage to teach him another way to accumulate the same advantages that he took outside the law. It ought to occur to somebody, and talk of excuses and blame doesn't really get us anywhere, but a lot of rather interesting and proper feelings. I'm interested in reasons. If a man commits a crime, what's the reason? Because until you find out the reason and work on that, you haven't corrected much.
But one of the reasons is that he may be a wicked man.
Wicked people, as such, are rather rare in my experience, and I have opportunity to meet many, if indeed they exist. People who are unsuccessful, sometimes horribly so, when they commit murder, are much more common than wicked people. Wicked people are the witches that we used to burn in Massachusetts 300 years ago when, with the revealed wisdom of some kind of Ouija board, it was determined that a witch should be stoned to death or hung.
How do you know they weren't witches?
Well, there's very little scientific evidence to suggest that they were, but it was fashionable at the time to attribute many of the maladies that were otherwise unexplainable to the work of witches.
Yeah, but you're shifting the categories here now. I said that some people are wicked, and you've just given me a homily on the fact that the wicked people are a small percentage of the whole. I thank you for the homily. Let me repeat, there are some wicked people, right? And what do you do about them, and how do you spot them?
There are wicked people in every phase of society, and probably a few more in my day-to-day encounters than in yours, perhaps. But the word wickedness doesn't really help me much. It's like the word evil. Every human being trots around with some purpose somewhere, and he thinks that what he is doing is going to make him happier than if he didn't do it. Otherwise, he wouldn't do it. Starting with that premise, which is my own philosophy, how do you isolate
wickedness?
Make him
happy irrespective of what it does to other people.
Certainly, but people who
it makes a sadist happy to hit other people, right?
It gratifies him because the sadist is sick.
Yeah, that's right.
He's twisted.
That's right, yeah.
All right. The only people that you might characterize as wicked are those that are simply doing what they're doing criminally because it's more convenient than to do it within the law. The people that I have no feeling for whatsoever are professional killers, for one. But I count that man as not much worse than a governor who won't commute a death sentence because it's unpolitical, even though he has grave doubts about the guilt of the man that's about to be buried beyond all the correction of the injustice.
Well, I think that's slightly unjust as a comparison, because there are governors who believe that the prerogative of commutation ought not likely to be exercised, that he is there to implement what the legislators thought.
Gentlemen,
was.
We have a number of other points on which we'd like to touch after this brief interruption. Gentlemen, we have a number of questions that we would like to direct to you. They have been compiled by the firing line staff. Neither of Mr. Buckley nor Mr. Bailey has seen them prior to this time. I will direct specific questions to you, and if your opposite number has a comment or a rebuttal, please feel free to do so. We'll direct this first one to you, Mr. Bailey. What is your primary purpose in taking what are referred to as sensational cases? Is it the money, notoriety, adventure, or what category does it fall into?
There's no simple answer. Sometimes it's the challenge, sometimes it's the money, and sometimes it's just being obstinate.
I don't imagine that requires a rebuttal, does it, Mr. Buckley? Or does it?
No, I think you covered the field.
We'll direct this question to you, sir. If a lawyer knew beyond question that his client was innocent, would he be acting properly, insofar as you're concerned, in falsifying evidence to prove that innocent? Now, we must assume that his client would otherwise be convicted.
Well, I think I'd better give you the legal answer, since I see my attorney in the room. The answer is no. He would not be so justified. He would have to make his representations by other means.
Mr. Bailey, are there circumstances under which an attorney can justify this?
None.
None whatsoever?
None.
All right. Let's direct this question to you. And again, Mr. Bailey, how do you rationalize the fact that you have gotten acquittals for men that you knew to be legally guilty?
There's only one case where that really happened, in just the terms that you put it. Sometimes they get a conviction different in degree than that which might have been warranted if the defendant had told his all. But in the one case where it happened, I tried desperately to put the man in prison, and the state's attorney held out for a capital conviction, and he shot for the moon and got nothing.
In effect, then, it was the state's attorney who was...
I think so. The judge encouraged him to take manslaughter. I tried to get him to do it. He wouldn't do it, so the fellow got convicted of simple assault, which is nothing.
Do you have anything you'd like to add, Mr. Buckley?
No, I don't.
Mr. Buckley, is it... We will exclude Mr. Bailey from the answer to this, incidentally. Is it fair to judge lawyers by the clients they keep? For example, is it fair to speak disparagingly of what we refer to as gangland or underworld lawyers?
Well, let's start first with the question, is it reasonable? Sometimes certain things that are reasonable are not necessarily fair. I think that it is true that there are some people who specialize in defending people who are generally thought of as guilty. I don't think that the lawyers are entitled to rule as adamantly as they do, that only the jury has the right, finally, to establish whether a person is guilty or innocent in the eyes of the body public. I think the body public is entitled to make its own determinations concerning the guilt or the innocence of a particular defendant, provided it has conscientiously searched the record. So that I hope, just as free to say that I consider certain people guilty who, in fact, have been proven not guilty, as Mr. Bailey is, to say that he knows people to have been guilty whom he has sprung.
I would like again, Mr. Bailey, to go back to our original point, and that is the reference to the attorney and the, quote, type of client he has and his associations with dubious characters.
Well, I have very little time for the attorney who is on retainer by the syndicate to win cases however he can. These are the jury fixers and the manufacturers of perjured stories, and they should be disbarred if isolated. But the fact that one defends a large number of unpopular clients is no indication that he is a bad citizen morally or that he has low ethics, and I'm sure that Eddie Williams, if he stops trying Bobby Baker's case long enough to pick up this last comment, will feel his toes curl, because despite the fact that many of his clients are unpopular, he is a man of very high standards when it comes to the practice of law, in my opinion.
I'd like to direct this next question to you, Mr. Bailey. Mm-hmm. We would obviously...
Well, may I just comment on that?
Yes, sir.
I didn't say that Mr. Williams is not a man of high standards concerning the practice of law. I think that's, if I may say so, gratuitous. What I said has nothing to do with whether or not he has high standards. I'm not accusing Mr. Williams of fixing juries or the rest of it. I'm simply saying that I, exercising my rights under the First Amendment, an amendment the sanctity of which Mr. Williams has frequently stressed, am entitled to believe that the majority or X number or however number of people I want who were defended by Mr. Williams were in fact guilty as charged. And that under the circumstances, when I see a wedding between Mr. Williams and one of his clients, I tend to draw certain presumptions against the statement of which I conspicuously guard myself. But nevertheless, I'm just coming clean for you, Mr.
Let me pursue that point further. Is it fair to draw conclusions from that association?
No, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, it's very difficult to say that one feels it correct to reject the verdict of a jury, because unless one has sat through the whole trial and heard the evidence as it unfolded, not as it appeared in the Daily News, one really doesn't know what one is talking about.
You're referring to the Daily News quotes or the Daily News as an overall medium?
Take it either way.
Either way. Mr. Bailey, we would expect to find among lawyers, generally speaking, a deep respect for law and orderly process. Now, would it then be safe in assuming that most lawyers who feel this way would then be political conservatives?
No, I think not. I certainly am not a... not even a political conservative. I find many, many defects in the law, and I rail against the system and its inadequacy and its archaic aspects, and I'm doing every bit that I can to change it.
Mr. Buckley, anything to add?
No, I don't think there's any correlation there at all. I think that many people can be, for instance, very fastidious executioners or fastidious revolutionists. Their behavior in their own particular profession doesn't necessarily indicate their broader political allegiances.
Mr. Buckley, in view of the fact that you have been involved in a number of very widely reported lawsuits, I wonder if you would assess the relative importance of the lawyer and the merits of his case.
Well, I speak as from a disadvantage since I happen to have the best lawyer in the entire world. So naturally, he influences my judgment on these matters. But I think that probably the principal difficulty is that many kinds of laws, that many kinds of difficulties one gets into, are evolving so that one never knows exactly what the Supreme Court is going to say concerning one thing or another. Mr. Bailey must have had the same difficulty.
Yes,
Bailey,
I think that's true.
Well, gentlemen, we thank you very kindly. We will be back in just a moment.
Thank you again to all of the listeners who have helped us reach this 100th episode milestone. And of course, a huge thanks to Nick from the True Crime Garage podcast for also helping me get to this point. Great words of wisdom from the Colonel. Don't forget, you can find all of their episodes by downloading the Stitcher app. As a reminder, I drop new episodes of Who Killed every Friday wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I will also be dropping a new season of my passion case this spring. I will be re-airing episodes every Tuesday until then. Look for episodes to drop on Tuesdays once the new season launches. As always, if you enjoy this podcast and my other shows, you can help support them by clicking on the donate button on the left-hand side of slowburnmedia.com. And that is slow minus the W. You can also contribute to the show via the Venmo app with my username at bill-huffman-3. I will also provide a link in the show notes. I'm serious when I say every contribution, big or small, helps keep these Slow Burn podcasts running. And you can also help support the show by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you listen to your favorite shows. Because those 5 stars, they actually help keep important cases that I cover, such as all the unsolved cases, in the spotlight. And if you'd like to stay up to date on the cases that I have covered, as well as new shows that I have in the pipeline, please follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. And again, thank you so much for helping me reach this 100th episode and tuning in this week. So until next time, be healthy and stay safe.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get $6,000 cash, give us each $3,000, we give you this.
Uh-huh.
You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com. or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.